Welcome to the Karamcast episode 17. I'm here with my co-host, Amy Lynn Chadwick.
Hello.
And we have a very, very special guest, Vanessa Malitsky Sanchez. Yes, that's right. That is my own flesh and blood sister, who is here in Los Angeles at our studio, Chemical Light Factories, for just a day between her trip to China on our way back to Ecuador. Hi, Vanessa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So happy to have you here. You've been on this unbelievable journey for the last 3 months, the kind of thing that people just dream about or talk about in fantasy novels. So tell me about where you're studying right now, this place that gave you a disbursement to actually go travel, right?
Yep.
They supported you financially a little bit on this journey, and that's nice. Where are you studying and what are you studying?
I'm at NASCAD College of Art and Design, now University, NASCAD U. And that's in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I'm doing an interdisciplinary arts degree. It's an undergrad degree, BFA. I guess it's a bit of practice and it is a bit of theory. There's been courses, for example, weaving, which has been practical, hands-on. I get to work at the loom and create textiles, but at the same time, I feel like there's so much theory involved in that, things that I still haven't even come to understand. I remember one of the first graphic design classes that I took when we were all introducing ourselves, and I mentioned that I was taking a weaving class. The graphic design instructor said to me, "Do you realize that the first computer was based on the loom? The fact right. that it was all binary, zeros and ones, and
punch cards."
Exactly. So sitting at the loom and seeing all the patterns that are created there definitely sends the mind wandering.
One of my favorite things that completely blew me away was a couple of Christmases ago, you gave me this herringbone scarf that you had made. Was it on a loom?
Yeah, on a floor loom.
The quality of it is just amazing. It has this weight to it and just this made-by-hand beauty that I can't even imagine what something like that would cost to buy at a Nordstrom's. But putting that thing around my neck, it's got this gravity to it that's just incredible. And I can't tell you how excited I was to get that kind of output.
How long does something like that take to make?
Once you have it set up on the loom, the weave structure that I did for that scarf, it's fairly basic. You're just going back and forth between two petals. But to set up the loom, before you actually put it on the loom, you have to do what's called winding the warp, and that's getting your threads ready. And something like that might take anywhere between an hour and 2 hours. And then setting up the loom probably takes in and around a couple of hours as well. Of course, it always depends on how complex your weave pattern is, how many threads, how wide it is. But for what I made for you, which is probably about 6 inches wide and a fairly basic weave structure, once it was on the loom, so the 4 hours of prep, it probably took about 2 hours to weave. But then a piece isn't complete until you actually finish it, so it's a matter of tying up all the loose ends and dealing with the fringe and washing it and pressing it. And once all of that is done and you've got a complete piece, you're probably looking at about 6 hours.
I find the whole thing about the punch cards and the loom as its sort of genesis, as a point of departure for what became essentially computing, so interesting, because those punch card sequences, the patterns for the textiles, are programs, they're code. Mm-hmm. And what you've been doing for the last 3 months is exploring the world to find new pieces of code, really.
Well, it's interesting because looking at the patterns in weaving, I guess I'm to a large degree fascinated by pattern. And pattern, not just visual pattern, but also language pattern. When you look at linguistics, any language, when you start breaking it down, you do see that there are a variety of patterns. Once you could figure out the pattern, you can start to figure out, okay, well, is the word masculine, feminine? Is it past tense? Is it plurals? Patterns are what give you these clues. So it's been interesting. I was in Peru before I went to China, and now I'm en route to Ecuador. And a lot of the things that I was looking at in Peru, my interest was looking at ancient and still present day techniques of weaving, and not just the way that they weave, but what it is that they're weaving as well. And what's interesting about Peruvian textiles is that there's a story within there. Their patterns are their storytelling. It's referring either to elements of the landscape, elements of the culture, of the food.
How would a Peruvian translate something about the landscape or about a food or about a family legacy? How would that sort of thing show up in a pattern?
Well, for example, something that kept on coming up was that the people there are still very much tied to the land. And the land informs us of oftentimes what we need to know. For example, I had gone to the ruins of Chan Chan, and within some of the patterns on the ruins, there were birds there, pelicans. And the pelicans, it wasn't just an arbitrary animal that they had chosen. It was an animal that had chosen because watching the pelicans had informed them of what the fish stocks were like, for example. There's another set of ruins, which unfortunately I didn't get to, but apparently within the patterns that they've carved into that structure, there's a variety of spiders. And again, it's not an arbitrary choice of insect that they've put there. The spiders were often used to inform them when the rains were coming. And so they would look to how the animals reacted, if they were running up mountains or how they were reacting around the water. Essentially, they were informed of if a storm was brewing, and they were able to prepare themselves, either their crops or if they need to, well, a variety of things, essentially,
sure.
You know, through plant life, through animal life, it told them if they were in the clear, if they had to start preparing for something. And so this knowledge, I mean, a lot of people weren't necessarily writing. The way that you passed on knowledge was through story and or through textiles. So these token animals that had informed them of the necessities that they needed for where they were living, these were things that they had woven into their scarves, into the mantas, which are these almost like blankets, which they use for anything and everything, to tie the baby onto their back, to carry their foodstuffs, what have you.
What actually started your whole journey? What sparked your interest in going to Peru? What was the exact moment and why?
Well, last year I had the fortunate opportunity to go to Ecuador together with 20 of my crazy family members. And we had gone for a 7-day trip into the mountains. And along that trip, we took a side trip to Otavalo, which is a town just a couple of hours north of Quito, which is an absolute haven for handicrafts. And it's a well-known town for their weavings. And we only
and got, the population there is primarily native Indian.
Yes, Quechua. Yeah. So back to pre-Hispanic times, pre-Columbian times. We only got to spend an hour in Otavalo, but we got to see, well, I got to notice all the different wools that were naturally dyed, and there was a woman that was selling pieces for looms and beautiful handcrafted bags and knit sweaters, and the list went on and on.
And this place is huge.
It's apparently the largest handicraft market in South America. To be honest, when I saw everything that there was, I felt like just curling up in a ball. I was so overwhelmed. It was difficult to try to take it all in. Only having an hour there, I felt like my time there wasn't up yet. And one of the wonderful things about NASCAD is that you're offered the opportunity to either do an exchange with a different university anywhere in the world, or you can do an independent study, which is what I decided to do, an independent off-campus study. And I decided if I can go back to Otavalo and spend a few months there focusing on the handicrafts that they do there and working with the locals, then, well, it would be a dream come true. And so that kind of inspired it. I still haven't gotten there. That's where I'm heading to tomorrow. But I started off in Peru, which was great because that's also another mecca of handicrafts and textiles and backstrap weaving. So it'll be nice to be able to compare the textiles in Peru as well as Ecuador. Both countries still have the indigenous of the Quechua living there. So it'll be neat to see how from country to country the textiles, even though they have similar principles, have varied.
Now, while in Peru, you didn't just look at the textiles, you did other interesting things, right?
You made one of those very important spiritual pilgrimages that people talk about. tell us about how you got to do this.
Well, I determined if I was going to Peru, there was no way in hell I was leaving that country unless I went to Machu Picchu. And I didn't want to just take a bus and go there. So I did some extensive research online to see about how to do the Inca trek. And there's a variety of treks that you can do for different periods of time. There's 4 days, 5 days, 7 days, 9 days. And online, I found a few things, but it was so radically expensive, I started to feel as though I wouldn't have the opportunity. But fortunately, last year, my cousin did a trek to Machu Picchu, and he passed on the name of the company that he had gone with. And I managed to find a really great price, and it just solidified that this was going to happen. And so I did a four-day trek to Machu Picchu.
You walked for 4 days up the hill, up the mountainside. How much did you walk every day?
Well, they started us off easy the first day, doing about 4 hours. And then the next day we did, the next day we did about 7 hours. The third day, which was the heaviest day, we did about 8 hours. And
this is on a steep incline.
Yes. Actually, the second day, even though it wasn't the longest day, it was the heaviest day because we climbed to what eerily they called Dead Woman's Pass, which the summit is 4,200 meters. As I say, the next day it was 8 hours, and the last day, which we arrived to Machu Picchu, ended up being about a six-hour trek.
Was it more difficult mentally or physically to do this trek?
I was going to say a bit of both, but I'd have to say mentally. It had rained the first 3 days that we were there. So that was difficult. We were kind of cold, kind of wet. There was definitely parts where it was sunny and we got to walk through tropical jungles, and that was absolutely beautiful. But between thin air and steep inclines and knowing that you're going for such a long amount of time, once I was close to getting to the summit of Dead Woman's Pass, I really started to break down. I was cold, I was tired, I hadn't really slept the couple of nights before, and I started wondering, can I do this? You know, all along the way, people had said, you know, it's all in your mind, you could do it, it's not that hard. And I thought, yeah, I know that. Okay, it's all in my mind. I know I could accomplish this if I want to. But I got to a point where I started to really wonder, can I do this? And I had to catch myself right there and then, because I realized, oh, this is what they're talking about. One negative thought, and I can send myself in a downward spiral.
Dead woman's path.
Exactly. I could get myself to thinking, no, really, I can't do this. I just want to sit down and cry. I'm too tired. And like the little train that could, I literally started saying to myself aloud, I can do this. It wasn't like the little train that could. I didn't say, I think I can. I said, I can do this. And with each slow step, I said, I can do this. But I guess that was something that was amazing about that day and that trek in general.
That's really why it is a spiritual pilgrimage, isn't it? Because you could really just drop down with a helicopter, but that would sort of defeat the purpose.
Well, it's kind of funny because when we finally arrived to Machu Picchu, there's about 500 people on the trail. But sometimes, even though there are so many people on the trail at the same time as you, there are times where you would walk for hours and not see anyone around you, which was awesome. But when we arrived to Machu Picchu on the last day, it was funny how the people around me that I had trekked with for the last 3 days, we all had a sense of entitlement because we saw buses starting to ship in all the tourists. We're like, what are you doing here? You didn't trek for the last 3 days, lazy ass.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. And I appreciate the challenge. And it wasn't just, oh, I did the challenge, pat on the back, this is great. I mean, the vistas are absolutely gorgeous. I think one of the most beautiful semi-precious stones, something called serpentina, a green stone. The Inca Trail where we were is paved with these rocks. I mean, you're walking on beautiful, beautiful semi-precious stones. I mean, there are some people that were so worn and tired from the trek, from the rain, from the whatever, and they just wanted to get to the campsite. And I felt like, look, it's almost like we're walking on diamonds. You got to stop for a second and check out what you're stepping on. And if you stopped for a second and got outside of your head, you could hear the beautiful chirping of all the frogs around you. And I mean, it was clean, clean air like you can't imagine, and flora and fauna that you won't see again. And it was nice to slow down. As I say, when I was about to snap there, I realized it's step by step. I can't even think about, okay, I'm going to get to the summit. If I'm going to get to that summit, I have to take this first step and then figure out where I'm going to take the next step. It wasn't nicely paved asphalt or anything. These are roughly carved rocks.
So it was a constantly uneven path as well.
Yeah.
You can't just fall into a sort of a hypnotic routine on there. You're always being kind of reawakened.
Absolutely.
It really confirms the saying, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey.
So you ran around Peru. You had a travel buddy for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to see a variety of cities there and towns. And
yeah.
Did you notice that they were radically different from each other within Peru as far as what you were looking for?
To a certain degree. For example, the Montero Valley, which I got to spend some time in, actually got to learn with a couple of Quechua women how to do backstrap weaving. And then when I was in Cusco, I did a tour around the Sacred Valley. And so the weave structures in the Montero Valley are somewhat different than in Chinchero, which are somewhat different than in Lake Titicaca, which was another place that I got to go to, which was phenomenal. Just a quick word on that. That's where they have floating islands. They've created islands out of reeds.
Floating islands that people can walk around on?
That people live on.
Wow. There's
one island where there's about three families there. They're all blood relatives, but three different families that live there. And it's amazing. It's, as I say, a floating island. They've got the island that's been made out of reeds, and they gave us a basic demonstration on how the island's actually made. They've also got boats called caballos toteros, which are horses. They look like horses' heads. The front of the boat looks like a horse's neck and head, and these boats are also made out of reeds. And even though they live very traditionally, very basically there, they've got a solar panel, so they're able to get their internet so they can get their latest news.
Actually, one of the most interesting things about the advent of global communications technology is that, ironically, in countries that were the least developed technologically, there are companies that come in and they'll drop down a satellite tower or whatever that suddenly gives the entire country cellular access,
mm-hmm.
which in a lot of ways is far stabler or more consistent than the possibility of a fiber optic pipeline being chopped up or eaten by a shark or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so similarly, we have these outdated electrical wires and electrical poles everywhere all over the US that could be taken down by a squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
You could knock out an entire power grid by an overzealous animal, which is what Toronto experienced a few years ago with that huge blackout in the Northeast. So the fact that these guys are using solar panels for their electricity actually makes a lot more sense, and it's much more advanced and stable for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if I would be able to distinguish, as let's say a consumer, somebody who's not studying the language of fashion and of textiles and so on, if I would be able to distinguish by looking at the difference between something that was created in one part of Peru versus another.
It's not screamingly obvious. One of the things that might be a sign would be you would start to notice differences in colors. Like there's a different color palette. Maybe to the naked eye, you would just see that, okay, well, it looks like in general, there's a picture, there's a stripe, there's another image, there's another stripe. And for the most part, they look fairly similar. But if you were to look at three or four from the valley versus three or four from the Cusco area around the Sacred Valley, and, you know, three or four from around Lake Titicaca, it might become more obvious because you would see that from the three different regions, there is a color range that they're remaining within, or that there's a repetition in the pattern.
Are the colors based on locally available dyes, or is it another reason for that?
Yep. In the Chinchero Valley especially, they focus on just natural dyes. So the colors are only things that they can get right where they are. One thing that I was really sad to come across was that there was a lot of communities that unfortunately are now using synthetic fibers because alpaca has become so famous and loved worldwide that so much of the alpaca is being exported around the world that local Peruvians can't afford to use their own fibers. I mean, we see this happening with a variety of things, you know, Costa Ricans apparently not being able to eat bananas because all the bananas are out for export. So in the Montero Valley, I did notice that a lot more synthetics were being used. So you had super vibrant reds and neon colors, which is a telltale sign that they're synthetics. I haven't seen a natural fiber or a natural plant that gives you your neon yellows just yet.
But what does this mean to you? I mean, does that matter ultimately? Is the natural source what's more significant, or is it the actual program that's being used to create these patterns in the end? Because obviously we're all happy that we're not using computers with punch cards anymore. Obviously we're happy to have laptops, you know, 8.9-inch notebooks that are the size of paperbacks and that are running full Microsoft Office. The point is what we can do with them, and it facilitates that. In this case, there's not going to be a depletion of the resources if they're using synthetic fibers. How much does that matter? Is it the actual weaves that they're using, the code that they're using to create these patterns in the textile, or is it the fact that it comes from natural sources, or is that a part of its importance?
I mean, it's a fairly loaded question in the sense that, yes, you can focus on the final output, but I also think about the process. I remember in a writing class, I had to write about 4 or 5 pages every day, and I can type a mile a minute, so I would type at the computer, no problem. There was my 4 or 5 pages. And I remember my writing instructor saying to me, it's great to see that you're keeping up with this, but do me a favor, write longhand, just because it's a completely different process. You don't have the editor on your shoulder. You're not deleting very quickly. It's stream of consciousness. So on the one hand, that aspect of process, there's certain value to that.
It makes you think differently.
It does make you think differently. I think that we're in a very accelerated...
And I don't mean Mac think different. I mean, actually think different.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, within the process of trying to make your natural dye, think of all the colors that you might find in between. There's a thinking time. There's a breathing time. There's things that you find that you wouldn't otherwise find if you were just kind of plowing through. And it's not to say that one is better than the other. They're two very different things. I think they definitely have their purpose, but then there's also sometimes having the computer as the tool, and then there's having the computer as the ultimate art or as the actual creative process.
Well, we can actually explore that by saying, did you see that there was any sort of radical difference in the actual patterns that were coming from the places using artificials, synthetics, versus the places that were still using the naturals? Were the patterns themselves changing?
The patterns were somewhat the same, but the hand is different. And what I mean by the hand is what it actually feels like, the weight of it, the feel of the fiber, because you need to use certain fibers to be able to get the colors that you want. And just the color in itself, I mean, you could look at neon yellow versus an ochre yellow versus a yellow derived from onions. And yeah, they're all in the family of yellow, but they have very different moods. They have very different effects. So yes, you do notice a difference. The weave structure is the same. The patterns might be the same, but what is creating the image of an orange on a computer versus with oils versus acrylic? They're both paints, they're both on a canvas, but it looks different. The texture is different. The way that the brush stroke translates is different. If you just want an orange and you don't care where it comes from, well then maybe choose the shortest destination to be able to get to that orange. But if you want something that's hand-grown and that has clean soil and no pesticides, are you going to taste the difference? Some people don't. Some people that aren't sensitized to it maybe don't have the taste for it. An orange is an orange, will always be an orange. To somebody else, they'll taste the nuance of the earth that that orange grew in.
That makes me think also that when you do get into the synthetics and the synthetic process and even the industrialized process where it's just a machine churning out copy after copy, what it actually removes is the possibility of deviation. There's that possibility that an accident can occur that would suddenly show you a better way or a more interesting way or a deeper understanding of something by virtue of that mistake or that anomaly or that deviation. So I don't know if I'm just also in appending to yours answering my own question, but I suppose that is the real risk that you're taking by going to more artificial processes.
Well, and I don't want to necessarily suggest natural versus synthetic all the way. I think more so it is, as you say, what you can learn in the process, what you can learn in the mistakes. I'm not suggesting let's use natural dyes and completely deplete our resources because we can get this one color. I think part of it, for example, I took a natural dyes class last summer, and you know, there was all these gorgeous reds that we could get from cochineal, which is a bug that grows on cactuses, which you get either in Peru or in Mexico, and that's farmed. I wanted to focus on the colors that I can get in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I am. And I think we're so dominated by a fashion culture of, all right, coral is the color of the season, so everyone do coral and everyone do this color and everyone do that color. I think for me, it was more about, let's see what we could find in our own backyard. And instead of having some predetermined destination dictate how we're supposed to get there, how about within the process, we find, oh, wow, look at this new color. Or, oh, my God, I never considered that a champagne chanterelle color could be so gorgeous. Because also with the synthetic, with the artificial, we've got so much synthetic and artificial that exists out there. So rather than stick that all in a landfill and forget about that, how do we use that? How do we incorporate that? And I think, again, when focusing on the process, or at least giving some time to think about and steep in the process a little bit, we can think about how to use these artificially synthetic made things. How do we give it new life? I think that when our answers are too quickly and we try to get to the destination too quickly, we forget how to problem solve in between. We're too quick to press buttons and to have the answer, boom, right like that, without any time to consider how you got there. And I know it's a cliche, it's not about, you know, the destination, it's about the journey, but hey, it's a cliche for a reason. The amount of things that you learn within there. I mean, when I got to Machu Picchu was mind-blowing. The architecture there, the way that they built it, the rocks that they chose, the rocks that they decided to leave there and build around, the location that they built. I mean, I can go on and on and on about how remarkable Machu Picchu was. Don't get me wrong, the destination was phenomenal. But I think what allowed me to appreciate that destination that much more was to be able to walk the same trail that these Incas walked and built to get there, to see the same plants, breathe the same air, listen to the same frog that they listened to, which is what inspired them, what fed them getting there. It's to understand the context made the final product something that I could truly appreciate. I don't doubt that the people that arrived to Machu Picchu by bus weren't stunned and in awe with what they saw. It's not that one was better than the other. It was different. But I'm so thankful for the fact that I got to take my time and really kind of stew in what there was to experience in the before and in the after of Machu Picchu.
It really makes me think about getting to a place like that, that high up above the clouds in these mountains, and thinking, this would be a pretty good place to build our tree fort, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No one's ever going to find us up here. And then mastering it. I mean, mm-hmm. building a fully working, functional structure city that's okay, that mm-hmm. worked out mm-hmm. really well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So counter to some of these ideas of the natural dyes and the textiles and everything and depletion of resources and finding things in your own backyard, you then went over to China to a tech conference.
Yeah, the joke was that my uncle picked me up in northern Peru and we were supposed to traverse the rest of South America, starting with Chile. My uncle's joke was that we did the same trip. We just changed the LE of Chile to an NA and we went to China.
Right.
So he had been wanting to go to China for years and years and years and see about getting into export with China. And
he's a businessman.
He is a businessman.
He likes importing, exporting, buy low, sell high.
Absolutely. And for a variety of reasons, he was too scared to go years before and then heard about this, the Canton Fair, which is a huge trade show that's in three phases with a variety of things sold at each different phase. And he decided, all right, it's my time. I'm going. And since we were cutting short our trip in South America, I said, hey, you want to come with me? And I was offered a trip to China. I'm not going to say no.
Of course. You'd never been over to the Far East.
No, I've been fortunate enough to travel quite a bit of the world, but I'd never made it to Asia. So it was the first time that I stepped foot on the Asian continent.
Yep. Were you surprised by what you found there?
Well, I arrived to Hong Kong and spent a couple of days in Hong Kong. I felt like I was in London in many ways. London doesn't have the sky rises of Hong Kong, but you definitely felt the British influence there. The metro system is very much like the tube they drive on the left-hand side of the street. I mean, there's a lot of things about Hong Kong that felt like many other great cosmopolitan cities.
So even years after the reversion back to the Chinese, it's still essentially feeling like a British.
I felt a familiarity there very, very quickly. And then we went to Guangzhou, which is in Canton province on mainland China. And on the train ride there, you could already see how the landscape was changing. At first, we started to see how the skyscrapers started to fall away, and we started to see farming communities right by the train tracks. In a way, it was amazing to see that no piece of land was wasted. Everything was used. And I thought that I was going to arrive to this tiny little village, but then I arrived to Guangzhou, and it's another metropolis that is ram-packed with skyscrapers. It is, you know, kind of Blade Runner feeling.
Blade Runner is a bit of a post-apocalyptic vision of Los Angeles. Did it feel that way? Was it sort of an industrial hellhole, or was it shiny and glittery and techno like Hong Kong?
A bit of both. The architecture was amazing. A lot of the buildings that I saw were stylized in ways that I haven't seen. New York has some beautiful classic skyscrapers. Toronto has some sleek Mies van der Rohe buildings. And Chicago also has some great feats. But in Guangzhou, I saw beautiful buildings that responded to feng shui, and they would have holes in these huge skyscrapers or buildings that looked wafer thin. And so the architecture was beautiful, but you look beyond that sexy 500 meter piece of glass and you see a white sky, which is a white sky that is just so full of contamination. Guangzhou does not see a blue sky. You have to leave the province. You have to leave that city to be able to see a blue sky.
I remember you writing in a letter that I wanted to post on one of my blogs that you said that the level of pollution there is considered to be abusive.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually a quote from the Fodor's book that I used as a guide for Hong Kong and southern China, which suggests that the pollution is pretty harsh. And in the summer, it is considered sometimes abusive. I was there in the spring, not in full tilt smog, which I can't imagine what it would be like, because the air was thick.
And what's this coming from? Where's this pollution coming from, essentially?
Well, Guangzhou and the neighboring city of Shenzhen are essentially the industrial hubs for the world. I mean, just consider the amount of things that are made in China that are exported all over the world, regardless of the continent, regardless of the country. Everything, unfortunately, right now is made in China. And that place that it's made in China is in Guangzhou and Shenzhen. There are huge environmental issues. Something that I had been reading just recently was that in 2006, the Gobi Desert that surrounds Beijing, because there's been so much land erosion there and there's no trees to absorb carbon emissions and so on and so forth, it was something like over 10,000 tons of sand were dumped in Beijing City in a week. And in that same year, there was 100 million urbanites around Beijing that did not have clean drinking water. Actually, I think they were saying about 300 million, close to the population of the U.S. Urban citizens did not have clean drinking water.
And how did the people there seem to be as far as their health? I mean, did you notice anything unusual? We're talking about millions and tens of millions of people, but did you see the effects of that, or people acclimated to this environment?
They seem to be acclimated. I don't know, it's strange. Guangzhou, and I could only speak for Guangzhou firsthand, but people there have both a love affair with cigarettes, and with the rising middle class in Guangzhou, they're seeing a love affair with the automobile that hasn't been seen since the 1950s. I don't know if it's out of, and maybe I shouldn't assume, but I'm assuming that it's a lack of education on the subject about the environmental issues, because people are smoking and driving and walking around in this pollution.
Do you ever notice, though, how people tend to smoke more in cities where things are polluted, almost as a reflex, versus if you're in nature and you're in a crystal clear, beautiful forest, smoking isn't the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, and
it's one of those weird ironies about people.
Absolutely. But in all honesty, there's a handful of rich people there. Most of the people are living on $80 a month. A lot of the people that I came across, they're never going to make it. Well, I shouldn't say never, but they have not left the province yet. There's a bellboy that I became friends with at my hotel. He was kind enough to spend a day with me and help me find a computer. He took me to all sorts of places to help me find a couple of cell phones and a computer. And I had been asking him, you know, if he had been to Hong Kong and if he had seen this and that. He'd never been to Hong Kong. It's an hour train ride. It's an hour train ride, not too far. It cost about $30.
But there's also a certain level of control over what people even get to hear about or not. I mean, the internet is controlled. Just the news is controlled, right, by the government. So
absolutely. And I guess that was one of the surprises that I had.
That was, by the way, a gross understatement on my part.
Yeah. In Guangzhou, you have Starbucks, you have KFC, you have Louis Vuitton, you have glorious shopping centers all over the place of 8 floors of designer stores. And it's easy to see all of this and get caught up in the
illusion.
Dream of capitalism. Absolutely. And I met a fellow who informed me that 5 years ago, Starbucks wasn't here. See all those buildings you're looking at, all that shiny new glass and all of those cranes? 5 years ago, half of that wasn't here. It's not even just how quickly it's grown. To refer back to this illusion, was that when you remove the Starbucks and you remove the Chanel, either real or copy bags, there is this communist state that you're talking about. After sending or attempting to send out an email where I was talking about what the Chinese government is doing in Tibet, talking about a variety of observations, for example, the shark fin soup on all the menus, I'd have to say 80% of the restaurants that I went to, and I wasn't fine dining every day, every night, 80% of the restaurants I went to had shark fin soup on the menu. A lot of the wet markets and a lot of a variety of other markets.
What's a wet market?
A wet market, sorry, is a produce market, and it's called a wet market because they're always hosing down their produce.
Okay.
But there's still a variety of things that are sold on the market that, with more understanding of how the loss of these things in our environment have an effect on our culture, you would think that they would be removed. I don't want to go criticizing a culture about traditionally what they eat and what they've done for years, but there's certain things like the depletion of the sharks in the ocean. That is something that is something that we all have to consider and recognize as a huge problem that goes beyond, oh, damn, we've lost another species of animal. The repercussions are much larger than that.
I discussed once in one of the podcasts about the film Shark Water, which mm-hmm. basically says if you lose the sharks, you lose everything because they are the oldest living predator that remains in the sea and they take care of all the business. If you lose that, populations grow out of control, other ones collapse, ecosystems collapse, and everything's really ultimately screwed. So mm-hmm. The shark finning thing is a huge problem. We were discussing earlier that a lot of times you say, well, that's a sort of cultural thing. It needs to be protected. Well, you're at a bit of a catch-22 there because you can say something is tradition, but you were mentioning how in Britain they finally started banning the fox hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument had been, well, it's a tradition. Well, tradition was great when we were all living in tribes or our populations were much smaller and the impact was much smaller. But now we're talking about millions and hundreds of millions of people. And if all of those people are trying to sustain traditions that were really essentially grown out of smaller communities,
mm-hmm.
it's not sustainable. It's destructive on a level that we can't even imagine. We've never been in this kind of place before.
Absolutely.
So in China, you were going to see all these tech shows. And there was even a fashion component to this that I don't think you got to.
No, unfortunately, I missed that. I was going to stay for that last week, but I must admit that I got a little bit paranoid and I decided to leave China. Maybe it was...
Hightailed it back for Hong Kong?
I did. I mean, I know that Hong Kong is still part of... It's still part of China. But this email that I had sent talking about a variety of observations, let me say, on what I was experiencing there in China, I try to send the email, and I've been copying all the emails that I send to myself just so I have, you know, basically an online diary that I've cataloged. I haven't become a blogger or anything yet, so just the CC on the email is my way to go. And I tried to send the email, and it didn't go through, and I sent it about 10 times, and it didn't go through. And then eventually I emailed Miss Chadwick over here, and I said, listen, can you please let me know when you get this email? For some reason, it's not going through.
This was the only email that this happened.
This is the only email that this happened. I had written another email about my experience in Guangzhou and just talking about, again, a variety of observations, but it had never been a criticism about anything that I had seen or experienced. This was the first one where I had actually mentioned issues about Tibet or about the Chinese government, about the shark fin soup. This email was loaded. I entitled it, I wanted to paint a pretty picture, but Big Brother was watching. And essentially, that is what had happened. Sure, I wasn't incarcerated or anything, but after not being able to send out this email, I had done a bit of research in a book that I had, not online, because I'm sure that I would not find this information online, that in China there's what's called the Great Firewall of China, and that the internet is state-governed. I went as far as reading that dissidents and anathema routinely sends foreigners to jail and to re-education camps. I wasn't familiar with the word anathema, and so I maybe foolishly went to an online dictionary and plugged in anathema. And I started to get the information that it was a dissident, it was a degenerate, it was an unwanted person. And within seconds of getting the definition, one page popped up, another page, and another page, and another page. About 100 pages popped up, and my computer started almost like bleeding out the horrible sound that you hear a rabbit scream right before it's killed. And I tried to close these pages. I was trying to figure out what was going on. The computer was just in overdrive, and I was trying to shut down all these pages. And just as quickly as I shut down a page, another page would pop up. And I've joked to you before about this, that it felt like the Red Army was right about to pop out of the screen and take me out to that re-education camp. I could not shut down these pages fast enough that I just shut down my computer. And I got a little bit freaked out. And unfortunately, you know, after speaking to my uncle about this and about sending out the email, he was like, you're not in Canada anymore. You know, and I made it across the border. I'm back in LA. Nothing happened to me. But I guess that was a very
total Thomas Pynchon moment, huh?
Oh, it was a sobering moment. That's when I was reminded that all the glitzy fake handbags and lattes in the world don't mean that you have your freedom of speech, don't mean that you have your freedom of communication. BBC is banned in China. You cannot access BBC online. If you have a blog site, you have to register it with the government. They want to make sure that you're not talking bleep about them.
A recent article I read talked about statistically, in the high schools, if you ask the kids what they want to be when they grow up, a wide majority of them says that they want to grow up to be hackers. And in fact, the enormous population of young aspiring hackers in China is a real problem and a real concern for U.S. security, internet security, all of that stuff, because there are so many of them, and they use government servers as target practice over here. So that's interesting that it's not even that weird to consider that what people want to be when they grow up in China is a hacker.
Well, I have to say that when I was back in Hong Kong for that last week, I a little overwhelmed by all the shopping and motivation to shop. I took a day to just go to a bunch of art galleries. I mean, I've definitely enjoyed all my art history classes at NASCAD, the university that I'm going to, but I have to admit that everything that I've been exposed to through school has been a very male Eurocentric perspective. Amazing masters, but you also start to wonder, was there never a female artist that had anything to say? Was there never a Latin American artist that had anything worth saying? So to be in Hong Kong and then to have an opportunity to be exposed to a variety of Korean, Japanese, Chinese artists was absolutely fascinating. And I have to say, the work was so incredibly political. It was amazing to see how much of an outcry and a frustration there was with red communist China.
What kind of art did you see? I mean, tell me about four of your favorite pieces that you saw.
I guess the ones that hit me the most were the ones that dealt with children. And there were a lot of paintings that had children in them. There was one artist who, unfortunately, I don't have his name right now, that had a series of paintings that were Red Baby number 3, Red Babies number 5, and so on and so forth. And in a variety of situations, it had babies that didn't necessarily look of any particular cultural background, but they were all painted red, and they were all put in these compromising situations. There was another one that, this was actually a Beijing artist, and I'm surprised, I guess, even though there is a serious control on media and communication, I don't know where that control stops, because again, a lot of the artwork that I saw of Chinese artists was so kind of biting and lashing that I'm surprised that this stuff was allowed to be seen. And as far as I know, these artists have not been exiled from the country. But one of them was a series of paintings of children, all painted in black and white. And they're paintings of individual children doing a cat's cradle with red string, and the cat's cradle is in the shape of a star. And I guess one of the reasons why that really affected me was this Nigerian fellow that I met who has been working in China for the last 5 years. He was telling me a little bit about the education in China. Now, he's speaking somewhat from firsthand experience. He's a geologist who has been working with setting up schools in different suburban areas, especially in Guangdong province. And he was saying that children aren't necessarily taught to think, they are taught to memorize. They're given information and they learn how to regurgitate that information. From a very young age, they are taught nationalism, not history, nationalism. To see these paintings of these children essentially fresh out of the womb, and they're holding this red star, not even knowing what it is, but somehow already knowing how to formulate it, it had a huge impact. This fellow that was telling me about it was saying that in Nigeria, this wouldn't happen. In school, you're taught a variety of subjects, your maths, your sciences, yes, your history. And maybe I'm describing this in a utopian way, but essentially you're taught this as a child, and with the consideration that as an adult, you will have the ability to make judgments, assessments, criticisms for yourself. And then you can look back at history and make your decisions of how people were mistreated, abused, slaughtered. So many countries, so many cultures have had their hardships. And it's not to belittle any of that, but I feel, are we going to be able to move forward and make amends and get to a better place if we just constantly cling on to how we've been abused? It just felt like nationalism and victimization were the educational order of the day. And this is being taught to kids that their ideas are just beginning to formulate.
I remember when we were in Las Vegas and we were crossing the street and there was a guy, a father there with a t-shirt talking about Jesus, you know, and we have to repent for our sins and all of that, which is fine. The guy's entitled to his opinion and his message and his thoughts on Sin City. But what was disturbing to me was that he had his 2- and 5-year-old children with him wearing the same t-shirts, swimming in a t-shirt that was just, you know, like it was like a dress. And he was dragging them along the street behind him, spitting out the same message, probably at 1 a.m. Just a thought.
I mean, as you say, that's done right here on American soil. And again, it's not to suggest one country's wrong and you know, it only happens here. I guess what sobered me up in that situation is that this is a situation that is ever present in so many places. Wake up to that. And I mean, that's one thing that I've really enjoyed about my university experience is that it's, at the end of the day, the subjects aren't going to get me set job. What they're reminding me or teaching me how to do is critically think. And I know that there's a lot of universities now that are sponsored by huge corporations. That's where they're getting their money. And I have to look at that, even pre-China experience, I have to look at that and wonder, okay, it's great that the university is getting money and that's important. We need to keep these educational institutions open, but how much of this corporate's mandate is going to be seeping into what these students are learning? And so, again, it's not bad China or bad any particular country.
I don't think you're giving off that message at all.
I guess it's just, let's be well aware of how we're teaching and how we're guiding people. And, well, I guess that's mainly it.
So just to wrap this up, how will your China experience, coupling back on your Machu Picchu experience, coupling back to your initial intention of going to Otavalo to study textiles, how will all of this, do you know yet how this is all going to work together in a thesis or in your next scarf? or is it just widening your perspective?
For right now, I'd have to say it's widening my perspective. On the one hand, you had asked me earlier if where my education is going, if it's practical or if it's theoretical. And I feel, in my experience, I can't have one without the other. For example, when I'm sitting at my loom, I'm making through technique a scarf. But the 6 hours that I'm sitting at the loom weaving there, I'm digesting and exploring new ideas in my head, playing around with those patterns. I'm seeing the relations that it has to other patterns. And so I'd have to say the two things feed each other. And although this began as a quest to go on the textile trail, the textiles that I was chasing down, it wasn't simply to make a pretty garment to wear to your next ball. It was looking to a certain degree at the semiotics of fashion, how this came to be, why it came to be, does it have any purpose now, what was its purpose before. All of this has both political, environmental, social, cultural impact. It's not something that could stand in and of itself. It's something that is connected to so many things.
So in a way, by looking more closely at the code, you unlocked little pieces of it, and it started to unravel for you a story about the cultures themselves.
Absolutely.
You were talking about your love of language, and sitting here listening to you discuss all these textiles and honestly the journey that started to unravel and take you to a different place. It took you to China, and it's going to be taking you back to Ecuador and Otavalo. You're basically speaking of the language of fashion, of this textile. It kind of ties it together, and that's kind of cool.
You're leaving to the airport in a couple of hours.
Yep.
And you're going back from LA to Ecuador after a day's rest here in beautiful California, where we actually have blue skies.
Yay! Everybody, if it's not nighttime right now, look outside your window. And even if it's a little gray, enjoy the sky. If you've got any definition in the sky at all, enjoy it, because it's not a blasted out white sky.
It's not a scorched post-apocalyptic no. Hell yet. Well, I hope
you... Get off your cell phones.
Yeah. Get off your cell phones and go look at the sky and be thankful.
Yes.
That's what we wanted to get across to you good people today. Well, I hope you have a safe flight back to Ecuador.
Thank you.
I hope that you finally do get to Otavalo on this leg and get to explore that far deeper than the first hour you had there afforded you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do look forward to following up on this with you. And of course, I love you. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you guys for listening through this truly engaging and amazing journey that Vanessa's been on. If you want to share your thoughts, feelings, feedback, expressions, social security numbers, credit card numbers, or otherwise with us, you can contact us at info@karamcast.com. That's KERAMCAST.com. You can follow me on Twitter @ConstantChange. You can follow Amy Lynn Chadwick on Twitter @SingsWithLove. And the Karamcast has its own little tweeting machine @KaramCast.
And don't forget, you can call the Karamcast at 310-929-7268.
Thanks again, and we will see you next time.